evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be with you this evening and grateful that you've decided to spend your time with us here on Coast to Coast. Tonight, we jump into the deep end of the pool, feet first, no life preserver. We're taking on some very big questions, and we likely will be hearing some truly unsettling answers, as well as speculation about fundamental assumptions about how the world works, the nature of reality itself, whether we're fooling ourselves by thinking we have anything to say about how our country is run or how our world operates. I first interviewed Joseph Farrell on this program a couple of years ago, three, 4 years ago, I think it's been now. The topic was exotic technology developed by Nazi scientists during World War II and what might have become of that technology. Since that time, this prolific writer, an Oxford-educated historian, has greatly expanded his take on things, and what he's come up with is not pretty. In the past 2 years, he's written three books that touch on whether a secret space program is being operated separate from the NASA program that we all know. And while that is a fascinating subject all its own, it's really just a tiny sliver of the larger narrative that he has developed, a disturbing indictment of the way things work on our planet, the idea that the levers of power are controlled by someone other than governments or elected representatives. Dr. Farrell calls these secret overlords a breakaway civilization, a term he borrowed from Richard Dolan, one that exists within our own civilization, but is separate at the same time. It's heady stuff, a lot to chew on. Joseph Farrell joins me for the first 2 hours tonight to discuss covert wars, celestial spy ops, and the people who truly call the shots on planet Earth. That's coming up in just a couple of minutes. Then in the second half tonight, even more big questions with writer Brad Olson, whose new book, Modern Esoteric, likewise argues that everything is not quite what it seems here, that history has been distorted, news and information cleansed, and events and nations controlled and guided by unseen hands. But Brad is perhaps more optimistic about where it all might lead than Joseph Farrell is, and he will speak about a revolution in consciousness that could sweep over each of us. That's coming up in 2 hours from now. First, a couple of news items. The search for the missing jetliner, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, continues. 9 days now, and no one has a clue what became of the plane and the 239 people on board. Teams from 24 nations now part of this search, which is currently focused on two sections of the ocean. Pakistan said today that the plane did not enter its airspace, was never picked up on its radars. India said pretty much the same thing. Investigators are zeroing in on the pilots, of course, and their political leanings, their connections. Searches have been conducted at the homes of the pilots, questions being asked about people who knew them. Perhaps you saw the story about psychics and remote viewers being asked to join the search. Uri Geller, excuse me. Uri Geller says he was asked to take a look at this mystery. I got an email from him today. He confirmed that he is focusing on this plane's whereabouts. I suppose if ever there was a time for remote viewers and psychics to prove their abilities, this would be it. The whole world's watching. Governments of the world obviously need help. Let's see what people with these abilities can do. Also in the news tonight, in Crimea, votes being cast about whether the people there will join a union with Russia. The BBC reporting tonight about half the votes are in. It looks like the Crimeans are heavily in favor of the move. It's 95% in favor so far, a landslide. President Obama has announced there's no way the U.S. will ever accept such a referendum as being legitimate. In response to that, on Russian television today, chilling imagery, a journalist who fronts for the state's own news group has some chilling words by announcing that Russia is the only country on Earth that could turn the U.S. into a pile of smoldering radioactive rubble. Nice. Subtle, those Russians, huh? Sad news in the world of ufology. I'm sure you heard the news on the program last night. Dr. Roger Lear died just before he was to undergo surgery himself. Dr. Lear has been a courageous investigator over the years, known for conducting surgeries on alleged alien implants of unknown origin. I'm sure he took a lot of grief over the years from his colleagues in medicine about his work, but as we know, he soldiered on. I'm proud that we got to interview him a couple of months ago. We have a tribute to him on the Coast to Coast website tonight. Also there in our NAPS news section, a link to a brief video snippet about Dr. Lear, a filmmaker I know. I mentioned his name on the program previously. Jeremy Corbell has been working on a documentary about Dr. Lear's work, and he was there when Roger performed his final, what turned out to be, his final implant surgery. Recorded the process from start to finish. The film was not quite ready for release, but it will be soon. You can get a preview of it on our website by clicking on the link we put there. Also in the NAPS news section, a couple of articles related to the missing Malaysian plane. Theories are getting pretty wild about what might have happened. Webmaster Tim Binal and I have also included a couple of UFO-related stories in our collection of news stories for the week. One about the anniversary of the famed Phoenix Lights case, which was noted this weekend, and a fun article about medieval drawings of rocket-powered cats. Why didn't I think of that? And if you drink a lot of milk or other dairy products, an article from Mother Jones that you might want to read. Take a look at the NAPS News Collection and the Roger Lear Remembrance on our Coast to Coast website when you get a moment. I think George Norrie is planning a full program about Roger's life and work for later this week. Friday night was the tentative plan, I believe, so you might want to tune in for that. A lot of people who work with Roger will be sharing their memories about what a sweetheart of a guy he was and an intrepid researcher at the same time. Time now for our first break. When we come back, Joseph Farrell, Breakaway Civilizations and the Secret Space Program. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. As you know, we speak often on this program about secret societies, the secret overseers of our world, people who hold the levers of power, who manipulate media, control opinion. We lump them in sometimes with the banksters, the evil banks that seem to call the shots. Joseph Farrell thinks about these topics as well, but he sees different patterns than most of us do. He's a guy who's incredibly prolific as a writer. But what impresses me most is his ability to connect the dots, seemingly unrelated events and people, looking for patterns. And the pattern he's discerned is not very pleasant to ponder, but it's something we need to talk about, think about. His newest book, Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilizations, is actually the third in a series. It's a trilogy about breakaway civilizations, secret technology, and how our world really operates. It's a monumental work of scholarship and research. I finished part three today, and Joseph, it's really great to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me back, George. A pleasure to be here.
I'm thinking to myself, when does this guy sleep?
It seems like you... I don't.
Yeah, I said it a couple of times, prolific, but boy, you really are on a heck of a schedule here. Are you in a race?
Well, no, not really. I'm just trying to. I've got several book projects I want to complete before I shuffle off this mortal coil. So I guess I am in a race. But yeah, it's those three books are really kind of. Even while I was writing them, I kept reminding myself, am I crazy? Or
Well, tell me that. Do you believe it? Is it for you an academic exercise that just sort of grew and grew, or is it something that in your heart you believe to be true?
Well, both. I do believe that there's something significant going on that began during World War II and continued certainly after World War II. And particularly, one of the things I focused on in this most recent series of books is precisely, as you said in your introduction to the show, and that was Richard Dolan's idea of a breakaway civilization, which I think is really one of the most insightful things that anyone has come up with to explain what's going on in terms of the national security state. But I got to thinking, if all of this is true, if we are looking at a long-term national security issue that is a response to the UFO, whatever it may be. And I think we're dealing with several different kinds of phenomena. But one thing that they are going definitely to do is they're going to understand that they have to make some sort of technological response, that response is likely going to be extremely expensive, and that it's going to require a financial commitment over a much longer period of time than the Manhattan Project. So these books kind of really delve into significantly the financial aspect of this whole story, and that's kind of what started it for me. But yeah, I believe, besides it being an academic pursuit, I certainly believe in the possibility of the scenarios that I've been outlining.
I thought it was really a brilliant approach to do a reverse engineering. This, not reverse engineering of like a device or some kind of technology, but a reverse engineering of social institutions. Is that is, if there is a breakaway civilization, what signs should we look for to prove it? Give me a laundry list, sort of the kinds of things that would pop up and the kinds of things that you cover in the book. And I know we'll get to some of them in more detail as we go along.
Well, that's an excellent question, and I've already covered one of them. I think you have to look for signs of a huge, vast system of hidden finance. And when I say that, George, I mean something besides the black budget. In other words, the $25,000 screwdrivers and $45,000 hammers. We're looking for something that's so off the books and so under the control of the military-industrial complex that it's going to manifest in a very, very different way. And that way, I think, is in the creation of huge amounts of leverage in the system that are at root based on a kind of fraud, and we can get back to that later. So that's the first thing I would look for. The second thing I looked for were indications from the people involved in the national security establishment, both during and immediately after the war, to see what their perceptions of what they were dealing with were. Now, in this respect, Mr. Dolan makes a very, very significant, crucial observation, and that is that this breakaway civilization is formed in the crucible of the Cold War mentality, and therefore that their approach to problems like the UFO or to post-war surviving Nazis or to the Soviet Union, what have you, are going to be more or less one and the same, and they're going to try to set up the financial network for dealing with all three of these issues. So that's the second thing. The third thing, I think, is perhaps the most crucial, and that is, given the fact that you're dealing with a national security structure that has to deal with these three very different and discrete problems, then you're going to be looking for people within the national security structure that overlap in their functionalities dealing with each of these three problems. And that narrows the focus considerably, because you're looking at certain kinds of people within NASA, within the intelligence community. You're going to be looking for people overlapping with technology and finances, the development of spy satellites, and the creation of covert operations capabilities. And that narrows things down significantly. But I think those three areas are the key areas that I look at in those books.
I should tell people that you name names in this book. I mean, you directly name the people that you think are involved, and you
yes.
explain why. And we're going to get to some of those names in a little bit. Before we let's look at the hidden finance part of it first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody hates bankers, banksters. You and I both use the term banksters. We've all got our own reasons, and I think a lot of people, though, they just hate them because they're wealthy and they get away with so much.
Mm-hmm.
You paint a whole different picture, though, that bankers, banker families of bankers and industrialists are sort of they've been at the heart of this thing for a long time.
Well, they have and they haven't. This is the other thing that emerges from my examination of this thing, George, and that is we begin looking at this hidden financial system in those books by looking at Operation Bernhardt during World War II, which was a vast Nazi counterfeiting scheme that counterfeited Bank of England banknotes. And this was done under the auspices of the SS. And the crucial point here, I won't go into very many details, but there is one crucial point, and that is when this operation was set up, it was under the direct control of Reinhard Heydrich. So in other words, this was coming from the very top echelon of the Nazi hierarchy. Heydrich pointed out in a top-secret memorandum setting up this department that what they were in effect doing was mass production of unauthorized Bank of England banknotes. In other words, they weren't looking for just counterfeit notes. They were looking for notes that would be so authentic that it would pass the scrutiny of the Bank of England itself. And ultimately, they were fairly successful in this because after the war, the Bank of England had to recall all of its issuances of pound sterling notes and reissue different designed notes because the Nazis had so successfully circulated so many counterfeit notes that had never been issued by the Bank of England. So that was one thing, and I think that became the inspiration for this post-war financial system. And the essence here, George, is that after World War II, and in fact, right after the Roswell incident, President Truman took the decision to establish this secret system of finance by using Axis loot, primarily the Japanese loot that had been looted from Asia, in a secret slush fund for this type of covert activity and research. Now, this is a significant step, George, and I hope everyone understands what this means, because it means, first of all, that they have to have the collusion of certain prime banks around the world in order to launder this type of money into the system and to tap into all of that Axis loot and keep it off the books. But the second and more important thing that it means is it means that the military-industrial complex, the intelligence complex, the national security apparatus, enter the banking business directly. And it's as a result of this, I think that all the talk that we hear today about prime banks and bank fraud and central bankers and so on and so forth, that this is a bit of misdirection because I think they are now the second tier players. I don't think they're the most important financial players on the block anymore. I think that's in the intelligence agencies.
You make a point in the book about how many of these big banks have people with direct ties to OSS and other right. agencies.
Right. Well, we think of, I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
Sure, no, go ahead.
Well, we think in that respect of people like Alan Dulles, of course, who was a lawyer for Sullivan and Cromwell. He worked for the OSS during World War II as the station chief in Zurich, Switzerland. And then after the war, of course, he became a very prominent director of the CIA. So this man had business contacts via Sullivan and Cromwell, the prominent Wall Street legal firm, and certainly had the financial connections via that organization. And then later on, of course, as the CIA director, he maintains these connections as well. So that's one very significant person we have to look at. But some others that we have to consider in this respect are people like Ed Lansdale, who becomes kind of a guru in post-war American intelligence covert operations. Because when you look at his post-war career, it's actually Ed Lansdale that brings to the attention, directly to the attention of General Douglas MacArthur in Japan, that he has discovered the existence in the Philippine Islands of vast amounts of buried Japanese loot that had literally been suctioned out of Asia. And folks, I want to emphasize that the Japanese operation in Asia of plundering Asia was as thorough, if not more thorough, than what the Nazis did in Europe. So in other words, we're looking at a huge pile of cash, of liquid assets, of commodities, of bullion, of precious gems. And it's Lansdale who informs MacArthur of the existence of this. Well, MacArthur, in turn, is the one that orders Lansdale to fly to Washington, D.C. and brief President Truman, who establishes this whole setup. So the other important person we need to look at is Lansdale, because, as I said, he knows of the existence of this hidden system of finance, and he becomes a post-war intelligence covert operations guru.
What became of that that Japanese loot and the Nazi loot? That's part of the story that you tell, and you also outline a lot of other ways that this breakaway civilization has been able to raise tremendous amounts of money to keep things going.
Right.
Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilizations, Joseph Farrell's newest book, is our topic, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the financing of this operation and then get into what its aims were. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Dr. Joseph Farrell, author's new book called Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilizations, UFOs, Oligarchs, and Space Secrecy. When we come back, we continue our conversation about how this breakaway civilization finances some of the stuff it's been up to. Stay with us. Much more to come. Joseph Farrell, before the break, you were talking about this vast treasure trove that MacArthur had and his folks had found in Asia. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned elsewhere in your book about the Nazi trove. We've heard a lot more about that, including this recent movie, Monuments Men, about all the art. Is there a way to put a dollar figure on what either of those was worth? Even guess at it?
Well, this is the problem, and I'm glad you raised the question, because no one really knows. In my research, what I've been able to uncover is that Martin Bormann and all those Nazis that made their way to Argentina had joint accounts with Juan and Evita Perón just in Argentina that totaled some $800 million. And that's in 1945 dollars.
Wow.
Now, that's a wow. Now, when we add the Japanese part to this mix, this is where it begins to get problematic, George, because no one really knows how much the Japanese actually plundered. And this is very significant because, in addition to all of this, they're still looking for some of this gold in the Philippines and so on and so forth. So we don't know what the actual amount of bullion that they sucked out of Asia actually is. And this is the major problem, because when you examine the official stories and estimates of how much gold there actually is in the world, what I'm feeling from the result of my researches is that those estimates may be off by as much as an order of magnitude. In other words, we might be looking at a supply that's almost 10 times as big as what people have guessed. And that itself is a whopper, because what this means, and I believe what they did in this hidden system of finance, was that by keeping this vast plunder off the books, what it did was it enabled them to create a huge secret reserve of credit-making ability. It created vast amounts of leverage in the system, which, in addition, if you rehypothecate all of those reserves over and over and over again, you're creating enormous amounts of liquidity that you can tap into for the purpose of these covert slush funds and black research projects. And what put me onto this, George, was the bearer bonds scandals that began to erupt right after the financial meltdown back in 2008. Because a year later, we're looking at the Japanese bearer bond scandal, where some Japanese men are stopped in Italy at Porta di Chiasso going into Switzerland, and they're carrying with them, as the Italian police discovered, $134 billion worth of bearer bonds, some of which are in denominations that had never been officially issued by the United States. And then there were two other significant bearer bond scandals, one in Spain involving the incredible amount of $2 trillion of bearer bonds, which were, of course, claimed to be counterfeit. And then a subsequent scandal again in Italy with the enormous sum of $6 trillion worth of so-called counterfeit bearer bonds. And I began to think here, what are we looking at? And the first thing that popped into my mind was Operation Bernard. We're looking at something of a counterfeiting enterprise on a mass industrial scale. And the other thing that just kind of made me question the whole thing, George, was the fact that when we heard about these stories, if we heard about them at all, the denunciation of these things as counterfeit was the common theme. And my problem there is, you don't counterfeit things that don't exist. You don't counterfeit $7 bills. You don't counterfeit 8 ruble bills, and so on and so forth. You counterfeit things that actually exist. So to my mind, there had to be a kernel of truth to these stories of these bearer bonds. And the thing that finally kind of clinched it for me was the fact that in the 60s or 70s, the Japanese Prime Minister Tanaka got caught in a set of scandals, and this was researched very thoroughly by Richard and Peggy Seagrave. Wonderful, wonderful research that they've done on all of this. Tanaka created bonds from the Japanese Ministry of Finance that had deliberately been encrusted with misspellings, with grammatical errors, and so on. And he sold these bonds to the very, very wealthy. And of course, with counterfeits like that, with intentional errors on the actual certificates, they could later claim that they were counterfeit if the person holding the bond wasn't playing ball. Huh. And I think that's exactly what has happened here with these bearer bond scandals. I think they represent a kind of a deliberate counterfeiting operation. And one thing that convinced me of this was the East Asia News Service, when the first Japanese bearer bond scandal broke, the one with $134.5 billion. When that broke, Asia News ran a story stating that these bonds were all but indistinguishable from the real thing. Now, that normally I would be inclined to dismiss if it wasn't for the fact that East Asia News was very, very closely connected with the Vatican. And of course, the Vatican is in the middle of its own international banking scandals. And the Vatican Bank would certainly be in a position, handling so much international clearing, to know if a bond was or wasn't legitimate looking. So all of this added up to me that we were looking at the modern tail end, so to speak, of this system of finance that was put into place during and after World War II.
You see any connection to the recent spate of banker deaths to any of this? I mean,
oh,
I would
boy.
Imagine that after you write 3 books about this, you see everything through this prism.
Excuse me. I do see a connection in this respect. Pardon me. And that is, you know, I've been maintaining for quite some time, along with former Assistant Secretary of HUD, Catherine Austin Fitz, and some other people, I've been maintaining since the Ed Snowden NSA spying affair first broke that this whole thing is as much about finance and international clearing as it is about national security, protecting us from terrorism, and so on and so forth. And I suspect very, very much, George, that these banker suicides are somehow related to this hidden system and to the possibility that it was expanded using all the modern technologies of high-frequency trading and electronic tracking and so on and so forth.
You know, you look at banks today, what they got away with. I mean, they stole something like an estimated $16 trillion from American families, ruined millions of lives, threw people out of their homes. Not one of them went to prison. We know today they're too big to jail, too big to fail.
Right.
It seems like the banksters are untouchable, that they could make whatever they need to finance a breakaway civilization just by playing games with fees and rates, even without counterfeiting.
Sure, absolutely. I think all of these things have to be considered. You know, the other thing that doesn't get mentioned much anymore in the news regarding all of these things is the fact that the derivatives bubble itself was in the quadrillions of dollars, I think something like 14 to 17 quadrillion dollars. And, you know, that vastly exceeds the entire gross domestic product of the entire planet. Now, when we're talking about all of that, again, the way I'm looking at it is that this enormous amount of finance has to be for some other purpose than just, you know, fattening and lining the pockets of bankers, because the sum of money is so astronomical. It calls into question what you would want that sum of money for. And I go back to the post-war period that the national security establishment is confronted with three major threats that it has to deal with all at the same time. It's dealing with the communist bloc. It knows it's got some sort of post-war Nazi thing out there continuing its own research. But most significantly, and at the center of all of this, it has UFO activity that has monitored very closely our nuclear developments. I covered that in Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, and citing the excellent research of Robert Hastings, who's done yeoman's work showing the interest of and activities of UFOs in relationship to thermonuclear weapons tests, to ours and the Soviets' nuclear arsenals, and so on. So they had a real problem. And I think, in a nutshell, what their problem was they had determined that this activity was sort of hostile. In other words, it could be interpreted as threatening, but it wasn't immediately threatening. But they realized that they'd have to create a technology that could demonstrate some sort of emulation or parody, and that would require a lot of money, and in fact, much more money than the Manhattan Project consumed during the war. And that's the beginning of all this. I think you've got a financial system, in effect, that's deeply penetrated by the military-industrial complex, and that much of this activity that seems so inexplicable is ultimately tied to that fact.
So it starts off with presumably legitimate and justifiable reasons. Hey, it's the end of World War II. The commies are coming to power, and they represent a real threat. And then suddenly we're hit with this UFO stuff that throws everybody for a loop. Mm-hmm. We're going to need vast resources to come to grips with this. Mm-hmm. And then it sort of takes on a life of its own, right?
Yeah, I think that's the other problem here. I think that once you admit that a system, and let me be very blunt here. I have described this basic thesis on other shows and so on. And I've had people write me and say, well, Dr. Farrell, the system you're describing doesn't work. And it won't work. And my response is, I'm not saying that the system would work over the long haul. I'm simply describing and trying to tell you what I think they actually did. And you're precisely correct. Once you put into operation a system that is, in its essence, based on some sort of financial fraud and cronyism and so on and so forth, if that system persists over time, it becomes such a huge portion of the surface system, of the public system, that you really cannot disentangle the two. And I think this is partly what we're looking at today and why there's so much confusion about what's going on.
In the middle of your book, you have a great chapter about two reports. One of them is a hoax. One of them is real. And the Brookings Institute report, I mean, we've talked about it a lot over the years. I've reported on it a few times. I remember when I first got interested in the UFO topic, looking at it, because it's a seminal, sort of an important statement. But you've made me look at it in a whole different way for what it doesn't say. I mean, it's couched in very interesting language that if you look at it through a certain prism, it's all about UFOs and this existential sort of a threat. Talk about that chapter. I guess maybe first, the report from Iron Mountain, because I know that there are some people in our audience who probably think that that's still real.
Well, yeah, the report from Iron Mountain was a total hoax that was dreamt up by a group of kind of left-leaning liberal intellectuals during the 1960s. And basically, the report fastens onto the very same idea that I've been arguing here, and that is that the economy, by that point in American history, had become so geared toward a permanent sort of war economy, just as President Eisenhower warned when he left office, that they wondered what would happen if all of a sudden peace were to break out. And of course, the report, even though it's a hoax, is arguing that, well, something would have to be created to take the place of the vast expenditure that is levied on war and war-making capabilities. And they essentially came down to two different ideas in this fake report, and one was a vast global kind of environmental catastrophe, and the second one was a vast and huge space program. So that was kind of the backdrop for me, because the report, in a certain sense, even though it's a hoax, is really, I think, and I think they intended it to be, a kind of satirical but at root sincere criticism of what they saw had happened to this country after the end of World War II with the establishment of the national security structure.
And then the Brookings report, if those who are students of ufology will recognize that, it contained a couple of sentences that deal with, boy, if contact with intelligent life is confirmed, it could throw everything for a loop.
Right, right. Well, the Brookings report is so well known because there's that one famous passage that many people refer to over and over again that argues that if we do come into contact with intelligent life or its artifacts as we expand out into space, as you say, it would throw everybody for a loop, and therefore we'd better kind of muzzle whatever it is that we find out there if it should prove to be culturally or technologically significant, all right? That's the passage in the Brookings report that everybody thinks of. But what interested me, George, the most about the report was that it was really a report about the social engineering of public culture as a response to vast human space activities. And the most interesting part of that scenario, that as I read it closely, was it actually comes out and speaks about weather modification. It speaks about using telemetry for direct modification of people's thought and behavior. In other words, it was anticipating the entire transhumanist movement by some 4 to 5 decades. And the other final thing that really caught my eye is it talks openly and uses this terminology very directly of types of space propulsion systems based on ions, based on fusion, and here comes the whopper, based on magnetohydrodynamic drives. And that's its phrase, not mine. So in other words, it's using a terminology in the 1960s of a technology that has been indicated by certain developments both within the American and the British and the Nazi wartime and post-war efforts, and people like Townsend Brown or Dr. Ronald Richter in Argentina, these types of people are talking precisely about this type of technology. So for it to come out and acknowledge it as a possible technology being developed, and that's the other assertion it makes. It doesn't say, well, this might be a future area to look into. It comes right out and says, this is being developed. And that's a huge admission, because this report comes out, as you know, at the tail end of the 1950s, early 1960s, and it's telling the experts in NASA what's going on. So there is your indicator right there from an official source that some of this money is being used to develop some very, very significant technologies.
Technologies that have never surfaced in any legitimate national security or military program, not that we know of, anyway.
Yes, exactly. So, and this is the other thing, and it again takes me back to some of the peculiar events that I tracked in Argentina with Dr. Ronald Richter and his fusion project, because when he's secretly interviewed by the U.S. Air Force in, I think, 1953, 54, somewhere in that time frame, he tells them very directly that what he's doing is creating fusion reactions at temperatures much, much less hot and under much less pressure gradient conditions than standard theory would dictate.
Joseph Farrell, we need to take a break. When we come back, I want to get into naming some names and also why the cone of silence was dropped over research into anti-gravity programs. Covert Wars and Clashes Civilizations is the title of his new book. You ought to check it out. There's a lot to chew on. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.